It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. In 2017, New York Times conservative columnist Ross Douthat wrote that Donald Trump's cabinet should invoke the 25th Amendment, thus introducing U.S. citizens to the existence of an amendment to the Constitution that might remove a president from office. This week, someone identified as a senior White House official wrote an unsigned New York Times op-ed that the cabinet discussed doing just that, but ultimately didn't want to precipitate a constitutional crisis. So, what is the 25th Amendment? Has it ever been invoked? And has the U.S. ever dealt with a presidential crisis close to this before? We're going to ask that of Kenneth C. Davis. He is the author of Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, among many other titles. His website is don'tknowmuch.com. Ken, welcome to the program.
It is a pleasure, as always, to be with you. Thank you, Carrie.
So, looking back, have we ever seen this kind of conflict in a president's administration?
Well, I'd have to say that as a person who lived daily through the Watergate summer, uh-huh. watching it, that's the closest we can come with that. But even that, with perhaps a little nostalgia, strikes me as completely seemly. Compared to what we are watching today. So no, there really is no precedent for this level of what is happening with the administration inside the White House and certainly anonymous op-eds by presumably high-ranking cabinet official or White House official making such claims and invoking the specter of the 25th Amendment, mm-hmm. which is, as you mentioned, a curiosity to most people.
Yes, it is. So I want to talk a little more about this, the connection the Watergate issue and how it informs what we're doing, what we're looking at now. You said that was much more seemly. What were the differences?
Well, first of all, I would say that we had a president who obviously now we know had committed acts of certainly high crimes and misdemeanors because he was certainly going to be impeached if Richard Nixon had not otherwise resigned. I would remind people also, however, that we are in the 45th anniversary, the first use of the 25th Amendment with the resignation of Spiro Agnew,
right.
Richard Nixon's first vice president and a very, very fiery spokesperson and defender of Richard Nixon. He resigned in October of 1973, 45 years ago, and we all learned a little Latin at the time. The phrase, I believe, was nolo contendere, and I may be mispronouncing it, and everyone was scrambling to find out what that means, which basically says, I don't contest these charges, and mm-hmm. I'm resigning the office. That was the first time that the 25th Amendment got invoked. So even though we had this extraordinary moment where a sitting vice president resigns in disgrace, the process worked rather smoothly. And of course, Gerald Ford was then made the new vice president, the unelected vice president.
Right.
That then led to, of course, Nixon's resignation, and the 25th Amendment comes back into effect again, and Gerald Ford becomes president under the 25th Amendment, and then names another vice president, happened to be, many people will forget, governor of New York, Nelson D. Rockefeller, a long, staunch Republican figure. So this did happen. And, of course, it caused tremendous it didn't have the sense of a crisis. It didn't have the sense of things unraveling because the process that had been put in place under the 25th Amendment, enacted, by the way, after the death of John F. Kennedy, ratified, I should say, really made the process work. And one didn't feel that there was a constitutional crisis because the Constitution had worked exactly as the amendment was meant to work. We are now in a position where we're talking about the 25th Amendment in a very different context. But that was why I say it felt, looking back from the vantage point of this time, as much uproar as the Watergate summer and the Watergate hearings and the eventual resignation of Richard Nixon caused, it felt like the process was working. It felt like Congress was doing its job. I feel that many people today would say we don't have that same sense of institutional responsibility.
The process was working. You don't see the process working today.
Well, primarily in the sense that Congress, which is supposed to be a separate and co-equal branch of government, seems not to be exercising its full responsibilities in terms of oversight of the executive branch's decisions. And that's clearly and obviously because that both houses of Congress are in the hands of the Republican Party. And that's happened many times in our history. But it seems that the institution of the Congress, and certainly was true in the Watergate era, when there was much more bipartisanship regarding the investigation and then the ultimate move to impeach Richard Nixon. Of course, many, many Republicans back then, we don't want to, glorify this or paint over it, many of the Republicans back then also had to be dragged kicking and screaming to that conclusion, and it was really only the complete revelation of the tapes that so clearly indicated that Richard Nixon had been involved in an obstruction of justice and cover-up that led Republicans to finally say, yes, he's got to go.
So this anonymous senior White House official, and coupled with Bob Woodward's book, which talked to a lot of people in the White House, is this the equivalent of a tape? People actually in the White House saying the same things, saying these things?
I don't think that it feels like it. Certainly doesn't have the catastrophic impact of the revelation that Richard Nixon's White House conversations had been taped, and that then those tapes were then revealed, which of course took a Supreme Court decision. Again, we had a Supreme Court then that entered into this conversation and did its role appropriately in a historic sense, and ruled that these tapes certainly should be made public. And that was finally the unraveling. Because we are dealing with primarily the anonymous testimony of people who want to, affect some change, I don't feel that it has the anywhere near the impact of the White House tapes, which were eventually published in book form and made widely available, and every American at the time who wanted to could read them and see them. So there was no doubt that these things had been said and these acts had been committed. Right now, we are relying upon anonymous testimony, and that is, of course, always to some degree suspect.
So in Watergate, we've got about 30 seconds till break, but in Watergate, John Dean is the one who broke the idea of the tapes. And
it was actually a man named Alexander Butterfield, okay. John Dean was the key witness in testifying what was on those tapes.
Okay, so and when he, if that were to happen now, if somebody from the White House were to step forward now, would that make a difference the way John Dean made a difference? Yes or no? And then we'll get to the details after the break.
Yes, maybe.
Okay, fine. We are processing the meaning of the New York Times op-ed published this week and the history of turmoil in the presidency with author Ken C. Davis. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. In a scathing anonymous op-ed published in the New York Times this week, a White House senior official mentioned that the cabinet had considered invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office. The 25th Amendment has only been around, as you heard Ken Davis say, since 1967. And as you heard, it has only been invoked by three presidents, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. Nixon invoked it when he resigned, Reagan and Bush during medical procedures. But the section of the 25th Amendment the op-ed refers to has never been invoked in history. We're taking your calls. What did you think of this letter? Do you think that the 25th Amendment should be there? And what do we know about it? We're going to dig into that in a moment. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking this morning to Ken Davis. He is an author and historian. He has written Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About American Presidents. It makes me want to sing, Ken, when I read the titles of your book. So let's get to this, what we ended with before. John, I just remember seeing the tapes of John Dean testifying before Congress and everybody gasping when he talked about tapes and when he sort of gave much more detailed information. If somebody from the White House, who currently in the White House, were to go to Congress and do this, what would the impact be now?
It's, of course, impossible to say. First of all, we don't know the level of the person who wrote this. And, you know, certainly if it were a person with the stature, for instance, of the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, that would have far more meaning than someone who might be the Undersecretary for European Affairs and the Defense Department. So that would certainly play into it, I think that such a resignation would still resignation and public an announcement of this idea would have far more immediate effect. Right now, we've gotten into the situation where the op-ed, because it is anonymous, has really spawned this great big guessing game, making this yet one more aspect of a television reality show. Guess. What's my line? Who am I?
Right.
That's unfortunate that we've gamified this very, very significant moment in our history. So the fact is that few in history, very few cabinet-level officers resign in protest over policy. It's really rare. I'm scratching my head. Immediately, one comes to mind. One a little over 100 years ago, we were in the midst of World War One, of course, and whether we should get into World War One. And the Secretary of State resigned. William Jennings Bryan, and he resigned because he thought that Woodrow Wilson's response to the sinking of the Lusitania, which was pretty mild, has still gone too far. Bryant did not want the United States to get involved in fighting in what was then called the Great War. His resignation really was stunning at the time, but it kind of is a historical footnote at this point because, of course, then in 1917, we did declare war on Germany, and 100 years ago, right now, we were in the midst of some of the worst fighting of World War One.
So, Ken, I want to get to this. We have 7 minutes left, and I feel like this may take the entire 7 minutes. I want to know what the 25th Amendment is. Can you lay that out for us?
Okay. There are four parts to it, essentially, and it creates an orderly form of succession for the president and the vice president if they have to leave office, leave office either by death, resignation, or some other being forced to resign. It also covers a temporary disability, and that's the reason it has been invoked three times recently, once by Ronald Reagan, twice by George Bush when they were undergoing medical procedures during which they would be anesthetized and unable to fill fulfilled their functions. So it's the Constitution has worked well in those situations. Many scholars have argued that Reagan, when he was shot, should have the 25th Amendment should have been invoked. Then it was not, and there was no crisis that came out of that. So the amendment has worked well in those cases. It has also worked well in the case, as we mentioned earlier, of the resignation of a vice president, Spiro Agnew, and then the resignation of the president, Richard Nixon, both replaced and new officers named by and approved by the Congress. So this is worked. The part that has not been tested is the fourth part, which is when the majority of a cabinet and the vice president agree that the president must be removed from office. It's never been invoked, obviously. It's rarely even been hinted at, although during Ronald Reagan's tenure in his later years, there was some question about his mental acuity. He was examined by doctors and found to be fit, and so the issue went away.
And from what I understand, reading about it yesterday, I did a lot of research on this, a majority of the cabinet, so there are now 15 cabinet members, and eight of them would have to say, would have to write a letter along with the vice president to Congress, and they would send it to the Senate President Pro Tem, who is now Orrin Hatch, and they would send it to the Speaker of the House, who is Paul Ryan, and then the president would be suspended, essentially, and and then the president could there's a mechanism for the president to fight back and get his job.
That's right. He can contest this, and then it could there's a very, very specific calendar laid out of how soon this has to happen. And people would say, well, this is a constitutional crisis. Well, I don't think it is a crisis because the Constitution allows for it. So the Constitution would be working just as it was, as the amendment was written, and again passed in 1967, because the founders and the framers of the Constitution didn't anticipate many of these questions. And in fact, when William Henry Harrison died in office, the first president to die in office, there were questions whether John Tyler, the vice president, was actually the president now or just the acting president. He established the idea that the vice president becomes the president, although there was no mechanism then for naming a new vice president. So this was a question that went through American history for a long time until the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and then Congress realized that we needed to systematically state how this procedure should work.
Okay, so my question, I have lots of questions about this, but the next one is, if the vice president says, no, I'm not going to go along with this, but a majority of the cabinet does, can the 25th Amendment be invoked?
Not as I read it, and again, I'm not neither a lawyer nor specifically a constitutional scholar, but I would read it as whenever the vice president and a majority of either of the principal officers of the executive department or such other body as Congress. Now, that's
an interesting part, too.
That's an interesting part, too. That could be if a majority of the Congress were to vote such a thing. Again, this is all untrodden ground, as George Washington once said about the presidency itself when he took over. He said, I walk on untrodden ground. We are in untrodden ground here with the 25th Amendment. Obviously, it is a really high bar that the Constitution sets for invoking this fourth article of the 25th Amendment, just as it's a very high bar for impeachment and removal from office. The founders did believe that there must be a way to remove a president who was either treasonous or criminal or unfit in some other way, but they set that bar very high so it wouldn't just become a political act. Although Gerald Ford famously said in 1970, I think it was, that an impeachable offense is anything that a majority of a Congress considers it.
Interesting. And I think illegally that may be. I want to talk about the possibility of impeachment, bring in the idea of Bob Mueller, who is investigating a lot of things surrounding the president, perhaps even the president. If there are charges and Bob Mueller comes up with something and there's this specter of impeachment, if Congress changes hands, would that then maybe force the cabinet to say, okay, let's do the 25th Amendment, because then we can just kind of get it over with and we don't have to go through these long drawn out hearings?
Gee, that's highly speculative, highly interesting, and there requires a lot of moving parts there, mm-hmm. of course. And we don't even have any clue, because the Mueller investigation has been incredibly well designed mm-hmm. to prevent such leaks. We don't know when or if it will end. There's been some question about whether there would be any other announcements or indictments at this point before the election. There's a lot of speculation about that. So it's really, really difficult to say what would happen should Mueller make such an announcement, especially before the midterm elections. So much is going to hinge, I think, upon those midterm elections and control of either or both houses of Congress.
We have been talking to Kenneth C. Davis. He is the author of Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. He has been taking us through the 25th Amendment and turmoil in the presidency in history. Thank you, Ken, for joining us.
It's my pleasure. A lot to talk about here. We'll watch where it goes.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. 46 homes have been identified in Milwaukee as having lead poison hazards, but only 5 have been cleaned up since the beginning of the year. What's taking so long, and how are people being affected? Mary Spicuzza has been reporting on this. She is a politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joins us now. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So through an open records request, you recently learned that only 5 homes with lead poison kids had been made lead safe by the city of Milwaukee. How many more Milwaukee homes are out there that have lead poisoning and lead poison kids in them?
So that is a slippery number, because the city is really still trying to identify and track down homes that have lead poisoning risks. And that could be like peeling, deteriorating lead paint. They're concerned about lead pipes, lead dust, lead in the soil. So through an open records request, we were able to learn that through between the months of January and early June, so like the first 5 months of the year, that 46 of those homes had been made lead safe or abated is the technical term, but only 5 of those 46 homes that had been cleaned up had children with elevated blood levels or lead poisoning in them. So we were a bit surprised because this has been really a focus of the health department for months now. You may remember that the previous commissioner, Bevin Baker, stepped down very abruptly in January after it came to light that they had failed to follow up with the families of lead poisoned children, or at least failed to document those efforts. So they brought in an interim commissioner, Patricia McManus, and it was really kind of presented as an all-hands-on-deck trying to turn this around and help the families of lead poisoned children in Milwaukee. So when we saw the number 5 during those 5 months, we were a bit surprised that more hadn't been done. We have heard that some have been done since that request was made, so like between the months of June, July, and August. It sounds like perhaps as many as 11 homes have now with lead poisoned children in them have been cleaned up, but we're still waiting to get more numbers.
So I want to clarify here, 46 homes have been made lead safe, but only 5 of them as of June, and now 11 had kids who had lead poisoning in them.
Right.
Okay. And so are there more? Do we know how many more homes there are with kids who are lead poisoning? I mean, like how widespread is lead poisoning among kids in Milwaukee?
It's been a huge concern in Milwaukee really for years, and the city, to their credit, have been you know, making great strides to reduce the number of lead poisoned children. However, you know, obviously, no, there's no good level of children with lead poisoning. You obviously want to have no lead in any children. And I think part of what's happened is they have been lowering the kind of the amount of lead that is considered safe in the human body to really zero. That, and so they've kind of lowered the levels of when they start monitoring. So to be fair to the city, part of, you know, they're looking at cases that they may not have been as concerned about before. Mm. That said, you know, I think everybody agrees there are far too many children with lead poisoning in the city of Milwaukee. And really, this is a nationwide problem in a lot of industrial cities. We've heard of Flint, Michigan, Chicago, New York. It is, you know, and there's a lot of older homes in Milwaukee that still have lead paint, still have lead pipes, have, and especially it's more deteriorating lead paint is what a lot of public health professionals are concerned about, where it could be peeling, chipping, falling. Children could be putting their fingers in it, putting their hands in it. And also in the wake of Flint, a lot of people have been concerned about lead pipes and the lead flaking off into the water and poisoning children. So there's been a real push to have people get filters and filter their water, especially if you have young children, pregnant women, nursing mothers, especially, you know, babies who might be drinking formula mixed with tap water. That's obviously a real concern. Lead is a poison, and it can stunt growth. It can harm brain development and have a lot of really negative, like, long-term, lifelong health consequences for children.
So I'm interested in what this term lead safe means. I mean, you have ticked off a number of reasons why a home could have lead poisoning. Lead paint is one of them. Lead in the soil is another one of them. Lead in water, in the pipes is another one. And it seems to me that as I tick those off, they increase in cost to fix each particular one. So what does it mean to be lead safe, and who pays for that?
So there are federal programs through HUD, the federal housing agency that will housing and urban development, that they will provide funding to cities like Milwaukee to oversee lead abatement efforts, and that can be helping with things like getting rid of peeling, chipping lead paint, trying to go through and identify visible hazards in the home. Often it's windows, although they're trying to not. I think there's been a realization that they can't just focus on windowsills, peeling around windows. But when you're opening and closing windows, especially during the summer, that lead paint can flake off through, you know, as you're kind of grinding lead paint. So that is one thing that they really focus on, is trying to go into a home and find deteriorating lead paint and try to remove that hazard. I think that what we're trying to find out now is when homes were made lead safe, you know, was it sounds like they've been giving out water filters now, especially if they have lead pipes. We don't think that was always the case, and are pretty sure we're trying to figure out when they started giving out lead filters exactly, but that could be, you know, removing a lead paint hazard. That could be giving out a filter and encouraging people to use it and get replacement cartridges when time comes. Looking at, they really should be doing soil samples for those homes to see if, because a lot of kids, well, they don't just stay inside, they go and play in the dirt, and that could have lead in it too. So we're trying to get more information about what testing was done at homes and what efforts were made to make them, to abate them or make them lead safe, so children won't be, you know, essentially continually poisoned. And there was a, you know, unfortunate case that we learned about and actually did a records request for a disciplinary action on a nurse who sent really severely lead poisoned children back home into an unsafe environment after they were released from the hospital. Wow. And at the hospital, they were having a process that's known as chelation done, where it basically means that the lead poisoning is so severe that you go into the hospital and have treatments to have it, like, sucked out of your body, essentially, or removed, because it's such a high level and it's such a serious poison. And then those children were unfortunately sent back into a home that had not been abated or made lead safe. And that's we're still trying to follow up on that case. But the concern with that is that those children could essentially be re-poisoned, and almost they could like have their lead levels spike because they're kind of in a vulnerable state after having this medical treatment where their little bodies are almost like a sponge that could just suck up lead again. And so that's a real, that's a real concern. And I know that nurse was disciplined, and the mayor had actually mentioned that as a case that he was especially concerned about. But we are trying to get more information about what happened in cases like that. We'll kind of follow up with
okay,
that.
So one quick question before we leave. There was the lead reduction program was ceased in February. There was a stop work order. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so the public was learning about these problems with the health department. Bevin Baker left. A new interim commissioner, Patricia McManus, came in. HUD, the federal officials, state officials, all came in to investigate the situation. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore had requested the feds come in. I know the state was concerned. And so basically the federal officials issued a stop work order because they were concerned that essentially the lead cleanup or lead abatement efforts that the city was either doing itself or overseeing, having contractors do, was not sufficient enough to really make the homes lead safe. And they wanted to make sure that there wasn't, for example, like too much of a focus on windows and not enough looking at other issues or other sources of lead. So that said, we had been told that was kind of a temporary, wasn't going to put kids at risk through the stop work order. So we're still trying to figure out about did that slow this down dramatically or kind of what, as they were trying to clean up the problem, the interim commissioner has said, like, it was a mess when she came in, and it was more of a mess than people realized, and it took months just to get proper systems in place to move forward. So obviously you don't want to just be the person on the sideline criticizing everybody, but I think it is something that everybody is concerned about and wants answers on. And same with the question of what is poisoning Milwaukee's kids, how much of it is the paint, how much of it is the pipe. When you get a lead test back, it doesn't say this child was poisoned through X, and I think everybody wants to find out what's poisoning them.
We have been talking to Mary Spicuzza. She is a politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, you have one more, you have like 30 seconds. There is a new person who is running the health department. Do you have hope for her?
She is a Milwaukee native who was working at a Washington, D.C. based nonprofit. She was just sworn in as health commissioner after a common council vote this week. We've heard a lot of she really had quite a support network of people wanting her to be the commissioner. It was almost like people were joking that she could have ran. Alderman Donovan said he wished he had the support she had on his last campaign when he was running for mayor. So she seems to be very popular. So we have, I think, a lot of people are hoping the best.
Mary Spicuzza, thank you for talking with us today about this. We will follow up.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Aside from the op-ed in the New York Times, the other D.C. story that took the country's attention this week were the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh for Supreme Court. They were contentious, but were they consequential? Will hearings for a Supreme Court justice ever be as revealing as they once were? Or is this just a show? Rick Essenberg joins us to discuss the judiciary hearings this week. Rick is the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL. You have heard him on this show as part of our Week in Review. You recently heard him talk about Marquette Professor John McAdams, whom he represented. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
So how do these types of hearings typically unfold these days?
Well, they unfold in a way that's not very edifying. part of the problem is that one political party, generally the one that's opposing the nomination, wants to get information from the nominee that nominee is not going to give them and probably shouldn't give them. That is, they want to know how this man or woman is going to decide particular cases. And although it would be fantastical to think that somebody who is in the position to be nominated by the United States Supreme Court doesn't have an opinion on contested legal issues, if they, in fact, had no opinion, they wouldn't qualify to be nominated.
Mm-hmm.
Judges are supposed to keep an open mind on contested legal issues. They're supposed to, supposed to read the briefs, listen to the arguments, and think it through. And so, unlike candidates for political office, legislator, executive, they're not going to make a commitment to vote one way or another. Now, there are discussions that you could have with a nominee like Brett Kavanaugh, which would be very illuminating about judicial philosophy and how you go about interpreting legal text and stuff like that. And people like me would be really fascinated by that, but it wouldn't score a lot of political points, and it wouldn't get that key bit of information that the opponents want to extract from the nominee. And so we wind up getting circuses that go on where, we're talking about an email in which he said that legal scholars may not agree that Roe versus Wade is not the law, and that doesn't really tell us anything about this particular nominee.
We are talking to Rick Essenberg. He joins us to discuss the judiciary hearings that are taking place this week with Brett Kavanaugh. There were some contentious issues in the hearing. There were some protests at the very beginning. There were also some Democratic senators who have put some very tough questions to Kavanaugh to get him to say whether or not he supports a Roe v. Wade. That, of course, is the central question that a lot of people want to know. As we remember, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed, she was asked that question and she answered it.
Well, she answered it, but she also made clear that she would give no hints, previews of how contested cases would be decided. And so, if you wanted to get at, how Brett Kavanaugh is going to approach a case like Roe versus Wade, the problem with Roe versus Wade and the thing that has caused it to be so contentious among lawyers and judges and legal scholars over the years is that it essentially creates a right which is nowhere to be found in the Constitution. That is, the Constitution doesn't talk about abortion, it doesn't talk about privacy. And so it's what lawyers call an unenumerated right. It's a right that the court has recognized, but that it isn't listed in the Constitution itself. And so the conversation you could have with Judge Kavanaugh is, well, what do you think of unenumerated rights? Now, how do you go about, do you think they exist? Do you think courts should recognize rights that aren't listed in the Constitution? And if they are going to do that, how do they go about deciding if they are? And you might find out some things that would be relevant to how he would approach a case like Roe versus Wade, even if you don't get an answer, yes or no, how is he going to vote on whether, Roe should be upheld or not.
Republicans released roughly 42,000 pages on Kavanaugh from George W. Bush's administration. The night before Senate confirmation hearings, Democratic senators, especially Cory Booker, made a big deal about that. Do you think there was a strategy behind that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the strategy was to try to come up with some neutral-sounding reason to oppose the candidate. We typically... and there still is, I think, sometimes the sense that the senators should depose a candidate just because of their judicial philosophy. I happen to disagree with that. I think a senator can vote against a nominee for whatever reason that senator wants. Here, I think, you know, it's easier to say, well, we've been denied some information. But, you know, part of the problem is in today's world, when you want to see everything, a document that a person has ever touched, and we produce so many documents nowadays in the electronic age, because, you know, we send emails back and forth, those are all documents. It used to be that we didn't create that many documents. But it becomes really an untenable task. And you have this situation now where a bunch of people who announced long ago they were going to vote against Judge Kavanaugh are now complaining that they don't have the necessary information to decide whether to vote for or against Judge Kavanaugh. They've already made up their mind. Mm. And I doubt that in any of these, you know, emails we're going to learn anything that really changes what we know about this guy from, you know, now of, you know, public career that extends over 25 years.
But so the documents are there. They're public record. Isn't it up to the people who get the documents or who want the documents, whether or not they have time and resources to comb through them?
Well, you know, if you want to go over, you know, thousands of documents, then you're going to have to devote the resources to go through them. You're going to have to find a way of to do that. It can't be sort of a blanket reason to simply, you know, delay a nomination. It should be the case that when somebody announces they're retiring from the court at the end of June, that we ought to be able to get that person vetted and confirmed by the time the next term of the court begins in October. And so, you know, I'm confident that, you know, the Democrats can figure out a way to look at these emails if they want. If there's some, you know, dispute about, you know, whether certain emails should be privileged or not, I think they can work that through. But really, at the end of the day, you know, I think that Judge Kavanaugh is pretty much who he seems to be. He's, I think it's fair to say that he is a more conservative justice, but also I think by temperament, sort of an incrementalist. And one who is going to be a little bit more like Chief Justice Roberts, and who is likely to want to rule on the narrowest grounds possible. And if he's changing the law, to move the law incrementally and not in, you know, particularly bold or sweeping ways.
So you mentioned a delay, a strategy of delay. There also is, on the other side, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, who is head of the Judiciary Committee, said to Hewitt last month that that the point is, and this is a quote, the point is, we need to get this done, and we will get it done early this fall so that we don't have to worry about it being brought up in the election. How do you respond to that? That sounds like he wants to rush things just because of politics.
Well, you know, I don't know that he's going to achieve an objective of not having it brought up in the election. I think that both sides are going to bring up the Kavanaugh nomination in the election. And I think that, you know, the Republicans will say, look, we, you know, the president nominated this guy who has a stellar resume, who's a, you know, good, solid jurist. And the Democrats will, you know, attack him on the grounds that they want to attack him. And, you know, that message will either, you know, the party's respective messages will sort of resonate differently, I think, in different states.
And Rick Essenberg, we're going to have you back on as this nomination goes forward. We're going to be talking about this more specifically. I appreciate you coming on today, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.